Extend a family.
Visit us at www.efkington.com.
Come on down to EFK, located at 660 Bagot Street, for a great time. Be a part of our extended family.
Come to extended family. Come and have some fun.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I feel like TikTok just put the gun in his hand and told him to pull the trigger.
How many more children have to die because Snapchat chooses profits over safety?
Can't Look Away, a new documentary that exposes the tragic consequences of social media addiction on young people, from sleep deprivation to suicide. We'll speak with the director and a lawyer from a center that represents over 4,000 children. But first, Planned Parenthood under attack. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments this week over whether South Carolina can cut off its funding. We'll speak with Planned Parenthood CEO Alexis McGill Johnson. Then to Washington State, where ICE agents pulled over the car of a beloved immigrant farm worker organizer, Alfredo Juarez, smashed his car window when he asked for a warrant and hauled him away. He picks strawberries for a living.
Just try your best. This is how they want it. Yeah, so usually you have your pussy, you throw it in, you grab another one, another little plant. Like right here, you grab this one. Finish it. Grab another one. And that's how you go.
Nice.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's killed at least 112 Palestinians over the past day, including dozens of children and elders, in three separate attacks on schools where hundreds of displaced families took shelter. In the deadliest of the day's massacres, 29 people were killed when four Israeli missiles struck the Dar al-Aqsa school in Gaza City. 18 children were among the dead, over 100 others wounded, with dozens believed to be trapped under the rubble. Separately, Israel bombed a water desalination plant east of Gaza City, its latest attack on civilian infrastructure. Meanwhile, Israel's ordered the forced expulsion of even more areas, this time from southern neighborhoods of Gaza City. Many of those affected have been displaced repeatedly over the last 18 months.
We haven't slept all of last night. It was a bloody night. We placed roofs over us, but they flew away. We put up walls, but they fell on us. Where should we go? Where should we go, people? How long will we remain like this? How long will we keep evacuating and coming back every other day, evacuating, then coming back? Until when?
The United Nations says some 280,000 Palestinians have been newly displaced since Israel unilaterally ended the Gaza ceasefire in March. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights warns Israel's total blockade of Gaza, now in its second month, has once again created famine conditions for some 2 million Palestinians relying on food aid. The U.S. Senate has voted down a pair of resolutions introduced by Senator Bernie Sanders to block $8.8 billion in new arms sales to Israel. On Thursday, no Republicans and just 14 Democrats voted alongside Senator Sanders to restrict the sale of massive bombs and other military equipment.
In the last 2 weeks, they have intensified their assault against the Palestinian people. According to UNICEF, since Netanyahu broke the ceasefire, more than 1,000 people have been killed, including over 300 children, and more than 600 children have been wounded.
Among Democrats voting against limiting arms sales to Israel was New Jersey Democrat Cory Booker. His vote came just 2 days after he delivered a 25-hour speech on the Senate floor promising to resist President Trump's agenda. Stock markets continue to plummet as President Trump's sweeping global tariffs drew widespread condemnation and plans for countermeasures. China, which is now subject to a 54% tariff, just announced a retaliatory 34% tariff on U.S. goods starting April 10th and accused the U.S. of bullying. French President Emmanuel Macron called for unity among European leaders and for the suspension of investments in the U.S.
I think what's important, and that's all the work that must be done by the sector, that future investments or investments announced in recent weeks should be suspended until things are clarified with the United States. Because what message will it send to have big European players investing billions of euros in the American economy at a time when we're being hit? So we must show collective solidarity.
France is also urging Europe to tax U.S. tech companies as part of a retaliatory strategy. Canada introduced a 25% tariff on U.S. cars and trucks. Here in the U.S., the automaker Stellantis said it's laying off 900 workers at five manufacturing plants after Trump's tariff plan was announced and temporarily pausing production at assembly plants in Mexico and in Canada. In Washington, D.C., a newly introduced Senate bill with bipartisan support would limit Trump's authority to impose tariffs without going through Congress. In a separate challenge to Trump's trade war, the new Civil Liberties Alliance sued to block tariffs on China, arguing Trump unlawfully invoked emergency powers to impose them. Several analysts have pointed out Trump's tariff plan appears to have been based on math calculated by AI chatbots. South Korea's highest court has unanimously voted to remove impeached President Yoon Suk-yeol 4 months after he tried and quickly failed to impose martial law.
By mobilizing the military and police to undermine the authority of constitutional institutions such as the National Assembly and violate the basic human rights of the people, he made a grave betrayal of the people's trust, who are the sovereign members of the Democratic Republic.
On the streets of Seoul, crowds broke out in cheers as the judgment was announced. Yoon's declaration of martial law on December 3rd triggered swift lawmaker action and massive public protest. South Korea's election commission will soon announce a date for a new election as Yoon's removal takes immediate effect. At least seven people were killed Thursday after a boat carrying refugees capsized off the Greek island of Lesbos. Three of those confirmed dead were children. 23 survivors have been rescued. Separately, authorities in Turkey say at least nine people died Thursday in a shipwreck off its northern coast. According to UN data, 125 people were killed or went missing last year as they undertook the perilous maritime journey between Turkey and nearby Greek islands in the Aegean Sea. In Washington, D.C., President Trump fired at least six National Security Council staffers after an Oval Office meeting Wednesday with the far-right activist Laura Loomer. The firings came over the objections of National Security Advisor Michael Waltz, who was present at the meeting, and after Loomer reportedly handed Trump a list of people she considered disloyal. Among those ousted was General Timothy Hawk, who led both the National Security Agency and the U.S. Cyber Command. Loomer is a far-right conspiracy theorist, a self-described proud Islamophobe, and a longtime Trump supporter who was previously banned from Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for hateful social media posts. The acting inspector general of the Pentagon is launching an investigation into Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's use of a signal group chat to discuss U.S. war plans in Yemen, which accidentally included the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic magazine. The Trump administration warned school and state officials across the country Thursday that federal education funding will be withdrawn unless public schools eliminate all DEI, that's diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. The Education Department gave states 10 days to sign and return letters certifying compliance with the order. Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, said in a statement, quote, "In the middle of a school year, the president is trying to bully the very same school districts that he insisted just a few weeks ago should be in charge of education. He's wielding a cudgel of billions in federal aid to tens of millions of children to force educators to kowtow to his politics and ideology," Weingarten said. Members of Elon Musk's Doge operation have gained access to a sensitive data system that contains the personal information of unaccompanied immigrant children, including their mental health records and reports of abuse. The data portal is run by the Department of Health and Human Services, which takes custody of unaccompanied children. Many agencies contracted by HHS to provide housing and other care have been accused of neglect and abuse, including sexual assault. The data breach comes after DOGE made massive cuts to a watchdog agency within HHS that oversees the facilities where immigrant children are held. DOGE staffers were also granted access to U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services data systems. Illinois Congress member Delia Ramirez, who is the daughter of Guatemalan immigrants, said in a statement, quote, "They've ordered the abduction of immigrant activists, the erratic cancellation of visas, the use of infamous offshore mega prisons, and the violation of due process. It's deplorable that the sensitive information of temporary protected status, DACA applicants and recipients, visa holders, and naturalized individuals would be used to violate their rights," unquote. In Washington State, Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents raided a roofing company in Bellingham County early Wednesday, arresting at least 37 immigrant workers. Witnesses say the agents showed up in unmarked vehicles. Workers were rounded up and processed in a warehouse on site before being loaded onto buses. The group's now being held at the troubled Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma, where farm worker labor organizer Alfredo Lelo Juarez has also been jailed since last week. We'll have more on Lelo later in the broadcast. The Senate's confirmed Dr. Mehmet Oz to head the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. The former TV host and doctor has long supported the privatization of Medicare and Medicaid. The confirmation comes one day after Senate Republicans unveiled a budget blueprint, which includes $4.5 trillion in tax breaks for the wealthy that Republicans would pay for by slashing Medicaid. A federal judge on Thursday temporarily blocked the Department of Health and Human Services from terminating $11 billion in federal health funding that was allocated to states during the COVID-19 pandemic. Judge Mary McElroy sided with the 23 Democratic states in the District of Columbia, which argued the withdrawal of funding would create chaos and threaten the delivery of life-saving care. And parts of the central United States are bracing for potentially historic flooding after roughly 100 tornadoes hit the region Wednesday. At least 7 people were killed in Tennessee, Missouri, and Indiana as homes and, in some cases, entire neighborhoods were flattened. Severe weather alerts were also issued in the state of Arkansas, Illinois, Mississippi, and Kentucky, where Governor Andy Beshear warned residents Wednesday of more life-threatening conditions.
When we have this much rain, it's the decisions about when to get out, about what to drive through, when to go stay with someone else that can be the difference between life and death.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments Wednesday in a case brought by South Carolina to expel Planned Parenthood clinics from its state Medicaid program, even though states are largely already prohibited from using Medicaid to fund abortions. Planned Parenthood says the move violates the Medicaid Act's free choice of provider provision. Under the Medicaid law, patients are entitled to choose their own doctors. In South Carolina, that includes Planned Parenthood South Atlantic, which provides low-income patients with a range of services, including cancer screenings and full physical exams. This is Planned Parenthood South Atlantic's lawyer, Nicole Saharsky, during Wednesday's Supreme Court oral arguments.
It says that there's any individual may obtain care from any qualified and willing provider. So it's the combination of any individual may obtain care from any qualified and willing provider. It disables the state from doing something the state might otherwise want to do. Like we want to take this provider out of Medicaid for a reason that's unrelated to medical qualifications, which is what the state is doing here.
South Carolina, which is being represented by the Christian legal group Alliance Defending Freedom, argue that the Medicaid statute does not mention the word right or its functional equivalent, and therefore individuals have no right to sue to enforce the choice of doctor provision. This is Justice Elena Kagan questioning lawyer John Bursch, representing South Carolina during Wednesday's oral arguments.
You agree that the state has an obligation here, is that correct?
To provide benefits on the plan, but significantly
the state has an obligation to provide this particular thing, right, which is the state has an obligation to ensure that a person, I don't even know how to say this line without saying right, has a right to choose their doctor. That's what this provision is. It's impossible to even say the thing without using the word right. Has a benefit to choose their doctor? The state has to ensure that individuals have a benefit to choose their doctor? The state has to ensure that individuals have a right to choose their doctor. That's what this provision is.
Well, that language that you're focused on, may obtain, is not clear rights-creating language for four reasons.
I don't want four reasons. I want you to answer my question. The obligation is to ensure that individuals can choose their doctor.
Outside the Supreme Court Wednesday, both pro- and anti-abortion protesters held rallies as the justices inside considered South Carolina's bid to remove Planned Parenthood clinics from state Medicaid programs. For more, we're joined by Alexis McGill-Johnson, president and CEO of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America and the Planned Parenthood Action Fund. Alexis, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you talk about what struck you most about Wednesday's oral arguments and what they indicate, the direction the justices were going?
Well, good morning, Amy. It's wonderful to be here. You know, look, I think that inside the court, you know, the clip that you showed of Justice Kagan, I think, laid bare how valuable it is, once again, to have these critically thoughtful female liberal justices asking the plain questions around what is a state's obligation to ensure non-discrimination and the provision of dignity for every patient around a federal program, a federal insurance program like Medicaid. You know, I cannot read the tea leaves of the court, but I can tell you that I do believe that South Carolina had a hard time trying to prove that it had a right to take away the dignity of patients who choose to go to Planned Parenthood. And that's ultimately what this case is about. It is about whether or not Governor McMaster and his political agenda to try to take Planned Parenthood down in South Carolina really was in violation of what Congress intended when they set forth the Medicaid program and allowed patients to be able to have a free choice of their provider, right? And let's also think about why Congress did that, because states have been denying patients the right to do that. So I thought it was a very compelling conversation inside of the court, and I think it was made more so by the fine arguing of Nicole Saharsky, but also from those justices who really, really made it clear that the right to choose your own provider is just a matter of dignity.
And let's talk about even the state of reproductive care in South Carolina already. Almost 40% of South Carolina counties are believed to be contraceptive deserts. Can you talk about what kind of access, especially but not limited to low-income people who need that care?
Look, this is a story that we see all throughout the South right now, with so many of these states that have enacted these egregious abortion bans already had maternal care deserts. They had deserts where very few counties even have practicing OBGYNs. And the result of that is that you end up with contraceptive deserts, you end up with maternal care deserts, you end up with labor and delivery wards closing precisely because many providers do not want to stay in a state where they may be criminalized or fined for providing the care to the best of their ability to their patients. You know, Planned Parenthood is a health system that literally sits in the middle of the public health system and tries to strengthen it. Many patients that come to Planned Parenthood, we are the first point of entry into the healthcare system broadly. And the fact that Governor McMaster would want to deny patients access to care when, you know, many times we are the only safety net of the safety net they're providing care, just seems completely bonkers to
us.
And
talk about what that care is. It goes way beyond abortion.
Oh, of course it goes way beyond abortion. It is STI testing. It is access to contraception, wellness exams, breast cancer screenings, gender affirming care, you know, everything that someone would need to live a full and free sexually healthy life. And I think that, you know, again, in many cases, it is there's primary care being provided in Planned Parenthood health centers. It is just basic health care. And to have a state try to deny that is what this case is about, using levers like Medicaid.
Already South Carolina bans abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy?
Correct.
Can you talk about Texas? In 2021, Texas terminated Planned Parenthood from its state Medicaid program. Talk about this precedent and also what it means if the conservative majority Supreme Court rules in favor of South Carolina.
Yes. So, you know, look, we have states that have, you know, taken various measures to attack Planned Parenthood and remove us from, you know, their state Medicaid system. And the impact of that, again, is, you know, is on the patients, right? This isn't about Planned Parenthood. This is about whether or not the patients have the right to use their health insurance in order to get access to the care of their choice, of their choosing from their provider. You know, what will happen if the Supreme Court decides to rule in favor of South Carolina is that more states will act like South Carolina and Texas. Many of those states that have enacted the most restrictive abortion bans will very likely try to remove Planned Parenthood from its ability to or patients' ability to use Medicaid to go to Planned Parenthood. So it could have very devastating consequence on the patients throughout those states and their ability to get high quality care that we believe they deserve.
And can you explain what the powerhouse Christian legal group Alliance Defending Freedom is? This is the group that brought the case against Planned Parenthood in South Carolina.
Yes. So this is, you know, a group that should be no surprise was incorporated in Amarillo, Texas, so that anytime they can bring a lawsuit, they can go directly to Judge Kaczmarek, who is the only federal judge in the Northern District of Texas, a very friendly anti-abortion judge that, you know, has clearly opened his court to these kinds of cases and supporting them. We are before that court right now on a false claims case, a meritless case, where not only has Texas kicked Planned Parenthood affiliates out of the Medicaid program there, they are also suing to recoup resources back to the state. For all of the other services that have been provided in a bogus lawsuit that is intended to try to bankrupt Planned Parenthood. And I think that, you know, we are watching just a patchwork of, you know, very Christian nationalists and anti-abortion organizations work with this, you know, new structural advantage that they have, both with the administration as it currently stands, the Supreme Court, and the kind of patchwork of a judicial system that has, you know, been co-opted by right-wing judges.
The Trump administration's withholding tens of millions of dollars from nine Planned Parenthood state affiliates that provide contraceptives and other vital reproductive care, predominantly to low-income and people of color. The providers received notices this week stating their Title X funding was being temporarily retained due to possible violations, they said, of Trump's policies against DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. Health and Human Services has given the providers, which operate dozens of clinics nationwide, including in Indiana and Kentucky, 10 days to comply with Trump's demands to eliminate DEI initiatives. In a letter, HHS pointed to mission statements and other public documents that highlight the clinic's commitment to Black communities as supposed evidence of their noncompliance. Alexis McGill-Johnson, you're the CEO of Planned Parenthood. Your response?
I'm a CEO of Planned Parenthood. I am a Black woman. I am a, you know, someone who cares deeply about reducing disparities in healthcare in communities, as we all should. I can't think of any American who would believe that the color of your skin should dictate what kind of care you get. And that is what Planned Parenthood stands for. No matter who you are, no matter where you live, no matter what your zip code is, no matter how you identify, no matter your documentation status, we are there to serve you and ensure that you get high quality, time sensitive care. And so I think about the work that Planned Parenthood providers do every day, the way they are able to leverage a critically important longstanding program like Title X to fund access to contraception and support communities. And the idea that the Trump administration would take those resources away or attempt to spend those resources because Planned Parenthood is committed to improving health outcomes in community. That is essentially what they are saying. What they are not saying is that this is, you know, just another one of the dozens of attacks that Planned Parenthood is facing as, you know, people who want to use any means that they have to deny access and resources to Planned Parenthood because they are trying to advance their anti-abortion agenda.
So are you sticking with DEI at these clinics or the clinics?
You know, each affiliate is going to make their decisions about how they enact improvements to health outcomes. But at our core, right, at our core, reducing disparities, health disparities in community is what we do. And I think that's really important for us to move away from, you know, just these, you know, trigger words like DEI and actually talk about what those words mean and what they mean in practice for a community, right? Ensuring that we have representation of everyone so that, you know, we have people who speak the same languages as our patients so that we can give them the best care, that we have, you know, an ability to improve outcomes and ensure that people are getting the right resources to do so. And that, you know, everyone is actually seen, not just seen by a doctor, but literally seen for who they are and what they want. That is what I have in my healthcare system I go to. I know when I walk into my provider, they know who I am. They are able to, you know, see me and understand my particular needs. And I think everyone in America deserves that. And I can't imagine that this administration will be very popular in trying to deny other Americans that same right.
And finally, we just have a minute, but with Planned Parenthood under assault, you've also had a lot of victories. Among them, in Wisconsin, Judge Susan Crawford, who once represented Planned Parenthood as an attorney, trounced the Brad Schimmel, the judge who was funded by, among others, the richest man in the world, Elon Musk. The significance of this and other victories that you consider so important at this very fraught time.
Oh, Wisconsin was such a shot in the arm, I think, for this movement, for so many movements, because I think what it shows is that the good people of Wisconsin, the good people of America, do not want to be bought. They want to do what is right. They want the ability to make decisions, to continue to vote for freedom, and to ensure that their representation reflects that in their state. And I think, you know, all of us looking to Wisconsin, you know, have a lot of hope about what is possible right now as we fight back with this administration. You know, I also think, I mean, and the practical implications of that, right? We have a state that is, you know, voted in support of reproductive freedom, and to have a state Supreme Court to affirm that is going to be really important. It's also going to be really important as we approach, you know, in 5 years, the year 2030, and we hit a redistricting year, and so that we're able to kind of start to fight back structurally in the space that we are in. I'd also point you to Missouri, Amy. The people of Missouri voted to enshrine, to actually flip a ban, abortion ban in November, and it's only been within the last month that the Missouri clinics have been able to provide access to abortion. position, because even when you win, you still have to defend it with the state AG and the state house that may not be favorable. So that is the work that we have to be reminded of, that even when we win, we have to defend those wins fiercely and remind these electeds what we want and who we are and how powerful we will be to ensure that we get to maintain our freedoms.
Alexis McGill-Johnson, President and CEO of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America and the Planned Parenthood Action Fund. When we come back, we go to Washington State, where ICE agents pulled over the car of a beloved immigrant farm worker organizer, Lelo Alfredo Juarez, smashed his car window when he asked for a warrant and hauled him away. We'll speak to one of his closest friends. Stay with us.
As a new river flow in the night, and somewhere, honey, some old hog stomping on the bog, like a free stream of light. My heart jumps straight. And you seem like the kind of linger there, like a hot burning.
New River Blues by the legendary folk singer Michael Hurley, who died this week at the age of 83. Go to democracynow.org to see more of his performance, to see him singing his songs, and our interview when he stopped by our studio in 2020. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We look now at how the crackdown on asylum seekers and immigrants under the Trump administration's targeting labor activists, including the beloved immigrant farm worker organizer Alfredo Juarez, also known as Lelo. Supporters say he was kidnapped when agents with ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, stopped him on a rural road as he drove his girlfriend to her job on a tulip bulb farm early in the morning of March 25th. When he asked for a warrant, the agents reportedly broke his car window and handcuffed him. Lelo is now jailed at the privately run Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma, where hundreds have rallied to call for his release. He picks strawberries for a living. Democracy Now! Spoke to Lelo in 2016 when he was a 16-year-old farm worker in Burlington, Washington.
One of the challenges that comes in during summer was that sometimes I have to, like, leave school early. I don't get to finish school. Well, I remember that one day, I think it was a Sunday, that when we were picking strawberry, it was rainy, and then it was, like, super cold, like, the wind and stuff like that, and I was kind of feeling a little sick. It was, like, around 12, and I wanted to go home. So I asked my mom, and then she said if I, like, not feeling well, we should go home. And then my mom told the supervisor, but my supervisor said, like, if you guys don't get back to work, you guys will get fired, and then you have to find some place to live, like, just, like, right away. Like, at the same day, you get fired, and then you have to find a place to stay.
So that was Alfredo Lelo Juarez in Democracy Now! In 2016, when he was 16 years old. In 2013, he helped found Familias Unidas por la Justicia, an independent farm workers union in Washington state, with his friend Edgar Franks, who's joining us in a minute. Edgar recorded this more recent video of Lelo in a strawberry field.
Just try your best. This is how they want it. Yeah, so usually you have your bucket, you throw it in, you grab another one, another little plant. Like right here, you grab this one, finish it. Grab another one, and that's how you go.
Nice.
Today, Lelo has a hearing in his case. For more, we're joined by Edgar Franks, the political director of Families United for Justice, Familias Unidas por la Justicia. Welcome to Democracy Now! You've known Lalo for at least a decade, since he was, what, 14 years old. Edgar, tell us what happened last week.
Yeah, good morning, and thank you for having us here. Yeah, I've seen Lalo grow up, and it was really shocking to hear the details about what happened to him. It was around 7:30 in the morning, and he was doing what he usually does during this time of year, driving his partner to go work. Right now, the work that's available is at working in tulip fields. So he was driving, and no less than a couple miles from his home, he was pulled over, unmarked car, and he saw a gentleman approaching his vehicle. He cracked the window of his car a couple of inches, and when the people showed up to near his window, you know, he asked, "Why am I getting pulled over? And do you have a warrant?" The people asked for his ID. And as soon as he was going to reach for his wallet to pull out his license, they broke his driver's side, passenger side window. He got out of the car. His partner was upset. So he didn't want to, get more fear into her. So he stepped out, and within a couple of, not even a minute of interaction of getting pulled over, he was already in handcuffs. So he was taken to Ferndale at a holding station with Border Patrol, Ferndale, Washington. And a couple of hours later, he was transferred to Tacoma and the Northwest Detention Center. So, he's been there ever since. So we're hopefully, can do something to get him out.
And talk about the significance of this hearing today. What's being demanded?
Yes. So ICE had a statement that they said that Alfredo had a deportation order since March 2018, which Lalo had never, got a letter or a call. He never had mentioned it to us ever. He's a pretty honest person. So if there was something like that, he would definitely have shown up to his court date. But today, his immigration lawyers are going to go and present a motion to see if they can reopen his case and fight the deportation removal. I believe a couple of days ago, he was already in line to get on an airplane to be deported back to Mexico. And when he was in line, he was actually pulled out by agents and said that his lawyers already had filed or had sought a hearing with the judge. And today is that day. We don't know what time today, this Friday, but, it's a very emotional, very tense day because, the term, whatever the judge says, it has a lot to do with his case, and he's committed to fight this case, and hopefully he gets freed.
And can you also talk about, he's not only Mexican, he's indigenous, he's Mixteco. Mm-hmm. The issue of having language and resource accessibility so that indigenous workers can organize, and do you believe this is one of the reasons he's being targeted right now?
We believe so. We believe that the reason of his detainment was because of how politically active he was in bettering the lives of not only farm workers, immigrants, but especially the Mixteco community that he comes from. He's one of the few organizers in the state that speaks Mixteco, English, and Spanish. So, he can communicate with thousands of workers here. And, the proof is just in how successful the union has been. We passed overtime, got paid rest breaks, passed rules for heat and smoke rules. Alfredo had a lot to do because he's not only still working in farms when he's not organizing, He has direct contact and is always talking to workers about what are the needs in our community. So, you know, for whatever gains we've made in the last couple of years, Alfredo has been a crucial part, and especially because of how, you know, since he's been a young man, has been connected to the Mixteco community, which is a huge part of our farm worker community.
And it's not the first time he's been arrested and detained. When he was 15 years old, Bellingham police racially profiled him, pulled him over, detained him, even though he had DACA.
He was pulled over, you know, like any other teen, you know, for driving without a license. A local police officer from the city of Bellingham questioned him and was asking for like social security and where he really was from. And within minutes of him being pulled over on a traffic stop, he was sent to, again, to Tacoma when he was still a minor, when he was 15 years old. Luckily, some organizers were able to locate him and let the detention center know that they had a minor on their hands, and he was released. It was an incident of racial profiling.
I want to also ask you about the ICE agents raiding the Mount Baker Roofing Company in Bellingham, Washington State, early Wednesday, arresting at least 37 immigrant workers. This is a Facebook Live video that captured the raid, recorded by Giovanna Perez Juarez, whose nephew, Jose Manuel, was one of the detained workers.
The raid happened when they were about to start their shift. They're in unmarked cars. They're in vehicles that don't have an ICE logo or anything. They are being processed in the warehouse over there. And from the warehouse, they are being escorted to the bus. They are loading more people up in the bus. It is so sad to witness this. Being here is sad. Watching how they take away hard-working people.
Can you comment on this raid as we wrap up?
Yeah, you know, it's very, again, unfortunate. And
where were they taken?
What was that?
They were taken to the same detention facility where Lalo is right now?
Yes. I think right now what we're seeing is an attack on not only immigrant, but we think this is an attack also on workers. You know, I think Donald Trump has used this whole narrative of workers versus immigrants, but I think in the long run, it's an attack on labor and unions especially. But, you know, we tried a couple of years ago actually help a group of workers organize in Mount Baker Roofing, I believe in 2022, and Alfredo was part of that. Unfortunately, we weren't able to get the success that we wanted. But, you know, the Mount Baker Roofing, almost a lot of industries in Washington State rely heavily on immigrant labor, you know, farm work included. And we're seeing that this intensification of ICE and presence in our community is done, you know, to send a chill towards everybody that's organizing for justice.
Edgar,
it's no coincidence.
We're going to continue this interview in Spanish after the broadcast and post it on our Spanish website at democracynow.org. Edgar Franks, political director of Familias Unidas por la Justicia, independent farm workers union in Washington State that was co-founded by his longtime colleague, immigrant farm worker and organizer Lalo Alfredo Juarez, who ICE agents detained last week. He's currently jailed at the privately run Northwest Detention Center, a hero in his case today. That hearing is in Tacoma, Edgar?
Yeah, it's in Tacoma. Mm.
And we'll tell people what happens over the weekend. Coming up next, Can't Look Away, a new documentary on the deadly consequences of social media addiction on young people, from sleep deprivation to suicide. Stay with us.
And now I see the wind blowing from northwest, and I hear those honkers.
pieces by the legendary folk singer Michael Hurley, who died this week at the age of 83. Visit democracynow.org to see more of his performance.
The doors to this courthouse and the entire American legal system was closed to them.
These products were specifically designed to be addictive to adolescent brains. And this is known to the defendant.
Just me and Glenn and Laura down here up against the most powerful, richest companies in the world.
People say David and Goliath, but I said it's not Goliath, this is Leviathan.
We're gathering evidence that is going to show the judge that Snapchat's full of it. They say that we don't know how it works. We know how it works.
Hi, Michael. We're going to make a difference.
This is the first case that's ever been tried in this way. Based on the design of their algorithm, based on the design of their platform, not the content.
My son and his girlfriend had had a disagreement. Imagine having that sadness, and you're searching for help. And what you're getting is suicide content.
These companies have been gaslighting us for years.
This is all about money.
The purpose of all commercial ventures is to create a demand.
Our children are the casualties.
We need to take back the power from these companies.
They created a dangerous situation and then manipulated these kids.
They know the levels of addiction, sexual abuse. They know the levels of suicide. They're not showing our kids what they want to see. They're showing you what they can't look away from.
We all feel empathy for the plaintiffs and their losses, but plaintiffs have not and indeed cannot assert any legal theory under which Snap would be held accountable.
These parents are going out there every day and re-traumatizing themselves.
I'll never see his face again or hear his laugh.
If this can save even one person, it'll be worth it.
This is a fight I've been training for 30 years. All right, let's go to war.
Can't look away. Can't Look Away, The Case Against Social Media, a new documentary directed by the award-winning film team Matthew O'Neill and Perry Peltz, inspired by an investigation into child safety online by Bloomberg News journalist Olivia Carville. Today, Olivia wins a George Polk Award for her reporting. And the film begins streaming on Jolt and also starts a theatrical release, a theatrical run here in New York City at DCTV's Firehouse Cinema, DCTV, where Democracy Now! Used to broadcast from. We're joined now by the director, Matthew O'Neill, and the lawyer featured in Can't Look Away, Laura Marquez Garrett, an attorney at the Social Media Victim Victims Law Center in Seattle, which represents 4,000 children. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Matt, first talk about why you did this film.
You know, when Perry and I were first introduced to this subject through Olivia's reporting and through the team at Bloomberg News, we had that sense that probably many of your listeners and watchers have, that social media is vaguely bad, that it's invading kids' lives, that it's leading to addiction or too much screen time. As we got into the cases and we met the families that the Social Media Victims Law Center represent, and we learned the details and we heard from Laura and from Matt, it overwhelmed us because it is so much worse than you imagine, so much worse than we ever imagined what's being fed to children on all of these social media apps.
So, Laura Marquez Garrett, you were this high-end lawyer in Seattle, coroner office. Your future was made. Your kids would be very well taken care of. You have four of them?
I do. Four small children, yes.
And two are identical twins?
Yes, the oldest.
Okay. Yeah. But you decided to leave that. Why?
Because I have four small children. And so when I, you know, at the time, they're young enough, my oldest are nine, and I was not aware of what was happening. And when I first heard and I met Matthew Bergman, our founder, I said, well, what social media harms? I had no idea what was happening. When I met with him and read his first complaint, Selena Rodriguez, an 11-year-old who died by suicide about 2 years after she got her first iPad, I then watched Social Dilemma on Netflix. And when I saw these designers saying, you know, of course we don't let our children use these products, the attorney in me, defense bar, I was a member of the defense bar, by the way, not a plaintiff's attorney. The attorney in me said, if these manufacturers and designers and distributors don't let their own children use these products, they're not only harming kids, but they know it.
Tell us the story of 16-year-old Mason Edens.
Mason Edens, a young man in Arkansas, friends, family, no history of mental illness, and he goes through heartbreak. He goes through a breakup. And, you know, his parents, the devices are, they keep an eye on him. They make sure that he's not watching them too much. They what they don't realize is that TikTok algorithm, when it can turn fast. And Mason is going through heartbreak. So as he's looking for things like inspirational quotes, motivational speeches, TikTok begins to send him heartbreak and even suicide. I mean, we have a screenshot where he says, I think it's inspirational quote, and he gets sort of the, she never loved you, she never will.
I want to go to this 2022 case. I hate to call Mason a case. His mom is Jenny DeSirio. He dies at 16. She later examined his phone, as you're describing, and finds these TikTok videos that he liked that directly promoted suicide, some of which remained on the platform more than a year later. This is DeSirio, his mom, speaking to the Scrolling to Death podcast.
What I didn't realize is how quickly an algorithm can change. I didn't realize that overnight, literally liking one video, an algorithm can completely flip. And so in less than 2 weeks' time, the algorithm flipped on TikTok. So yep. I was that parent that was involved.
So I don't know, Laura, that people really understand when you say, oh, the algorithm, and it sends him down the suicide path. Explain exactly what happens.
Yes. So I want to start by saying what many adults don't realize is that these products, they're not designed to hook us, adults. They're designed to hook children, right? There's internal documents that say, get them young, the younger, the better. Literally, that's a direct quote. And so these products work differently for kids. So when Mason Edens is depressed and sad, the platforms know that and they exploit it. And so when he is searching for inspirational quotes, if they were to show him things like, hey, it'll be okay, go talk to your parents, go get some sunshine, right? What would he do? He'd stop using. And they don't want these children to stop using. They program for engagement. So what parents need to understand, everyone needs to understand, our children are having a very different experience on these products. It is not only the content that's being sent, it's the volume, it's the manner, it's the overwhelming nature, and the addiction that various mechanisms are creating such that they cannot look away.
Why are teens particularly vulnerable? Maybe that's a very obvious question.
Well, no, it's the development of their frontal lobe. And in fact, there are public meta documents with brain scan pictures saying like they're more vulnerable until they're about 24, 25 because the development of their frontal lobe, they're more, I mean, think about how our children act. Look, I have young children and sometimes I'm like, what is going through their head? They have not yet, their frontal lobe is not developed. They don't have the same reasoning or judgment that we do.
Charles Barr worked as an ad sales manager for TikTok in Germany. In 2021, he grew concerned about the app's algorithms pushing dangerous content. So he alerted company leaders, but his warnings went unheeded. Let's go back to another clip from Can't Look Away. It starts with Barr.
I think TikTok as an app has a positive side when it comes down to impacting culture. But what I see is that the platform is really not a safe environment for anybody within the young audience.
AI is pushing content that they know will be provocative, something fearful or anger-inducing, because we know that the more kids are steered towards this emotional content, the longer they'll stay online.
We asked hundreds of thousands of teenagers, have you ever received unwanted sexual advances on Instagram, 1 in 8, 13 to 15 year olds, yes, in the last 7 days.
If it has anything to do with drugs, it's going to be on Snapchat. This is where it is 90% of the time.
They're petrified of being held responsible for the deaths of minors. It's a perfect storm of corporate greed for maximum profitability.
So it started with Charles Barr. Matt O'Neill, if you can explain and also talk about fentanyl and drug use and what TikTok has to do, for example, with this. There is a huge discussion about TikTok right now, like, is it going to go dark? Who's going to buy it? But this is not the discussion that's taking place.
So much of the conversation is about foreign policy and China and who owns it. What Charles is bringing to the fore is this sense that TikTok entraps children, that it's not what they're looking for. I think we think sometimes you use social media to look up a news topic, or you think that these kids might be searching for drugs or suicide. That's not what's happening. They're being fed this content. It's not their choice. These aren't bad kids. The parents aren't bad parents. They're just without any real recourse in terms of facing these billion-dollar corporations. When it comes to fentanyl-laced pills, it's Snapchat. Snapchat has become a platform where young people have access to drug dealers. And the unique way their messages disappear is really appealing to someone who wants to sell drugs to a minor. And these fentanyl-laced pills that young people are often buying, thinking that they're not fentanyl, they don't know that they're buying fentanyl, has led to an unbelievable number of deaths.
We just saw the trailer, and in it is a young man who's in a wheelchair. Laura, tell us his story. He didn't die.
Right. Well, his heart stopped several times, right? And actually, so I was going to say, I mean, this is the stories people need to hear, the truth of what's happening. I have talked to many, many children who have said the same story over and over, which is, I was 12. I wanted to use Snapchat for the silly filters. You know, my coach, my parents, my teacher showed them to me. I began using Snapchat. I had never heard of marijuana. And all of a sudden, my feeds are filled with it. I'm getting these quick ad recommendations. And Snap says, this is your friend. Not only do they say to children, we tell them, watch out for strangers. So Snap said, okay, this is your friend, and I'm going to give you points when you snap this person. You may know them. This is what it's all about. This is fun. They make it look safe. And so I talk to these children who say, look, I'd never heard of drugs, and then I'm getting drug menus. And Snap is saying, this is your friend. I'll give you streaks and scores and trophies and charms. And so I add them, and now I've got drug menus. And by the way, now it looks cool. Like, there's kids my age doing this.
And what do the CEOs like Mark Zuckerberg understand? We only have 30
Everything.
Seconds.
They know. They know.
And what does that mean? How are you holding them accountable? Your organization, right. Social Media Victims, represents 4,000
right.
kids.
They are putting profits over people. They have known for years that they are hurting children. They have concealed that fact from all of us. They have told us their products were safe so that they can make billions and billions of dollars with no accountability. And until we start holding them accountable, they have no reason to change.
Laura Marquez Garrett is a lawyer with the Social Media Victims Law Center in Seattle. The film centers around her and many of the victims of social media. Matthew O'Neill is the co-director of the new documentary Can't Look Away. And Matt, where can people start watching it today?
Go to jolt.film now. There's share codes. One of the things that's important about this is that we want people to be able to share it with their family. And also, there's a discussion guide. So if you want to watch this film with your children, you can do it.
And of course, it's going to be at Firehouse Cinema DC TV tonight, premiering. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Wolf Island and Kingston Massive. Saturday, April 5th, Canada's Reggae Ambassadors, the Human Rights, invites you to join us as we celebrate the release of our new album, One People, at the Hotel Wolf Island. Tickets are $25 advance at thehotelwolfisland.com, $30 at the door. Show starts at 7:30, and we'll be playing two full sets. Check out thehumanrights.ca for more info. That's the Human Rights One People album release party, Saturday, April 5th, at the Hotel Wolf Island, right by the ferry docks. Presented in association with CFRC 101.9 FM.
The Independent Wrestling Academy is back on Saturday, May 17th.